From the studios of WBAA Public Radio in West Lafayette, this is Indiana Public Broadcasting's monthly conversation with Purdue University President Mitch Daniels. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. We appreciate you being on the show with us today. And if you've got a question you'd like to get on this program, you can always email that to news@wbaa.org. And you can tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. And let me start with a couple of listener questions that have come in. The first one says, in the past, Purdue had a partnership with the Indianapolis Public Schools to teach STEM skills for low-income students. Will this program continue now that you're proposing a charter school, and how will that charter school be funded as a separate sideline topic?
Thank you for the question. We have multiple STEM programs in K-12. In fact, if we have an issue, we may have a little redundancy there, but everyone appreciates the importance of this, particularly in areas where we have at-risk students and poor performance in the public schools. I bet that the questioner is thinking of a program called Science Bound, which will continue. It'll be folded into, as we see it, the Purdue Polytechnic Institute, and will continue to support students who want to pursue a STEM-based education and enable them to go to that institute as it opens.
And the question about how the institute generally will be funded?
It'll generally be funded, like other charter schools, with monies, a fraction of the monies that would go to the traditional public schools in the area. So we hope to work this out, by the way, in concert with the Indianapolis Public Schools and be in essence, co-sponsored by them. And so some funds would come from there. We'll probably raise some funds philanthropically, and then we'll just see where we are. But we think it's a very important venture. Been a lot of interest, by the way. From the very moment we began talking about this, we heard from people who really clearly have a heart for inner-city education, particularly for STEM education. We've heard from people, we've heard from foundations and others who are excited about this prospect, and also from some friends of Purdue who see this, as we see this, as one way we might build our own pipeline of first-generation, low-income minority students that are so very hard to find these days.
And remind me, what's the timeline on deciding whether this is actually going to happen and whether you're going to get all this worked out?
We're committed to doing it. Right now, the timeline is to open in the fall of 17.
All right. Another listener question. Ethan has written in saying, shortly before assuming the job of president, then-Governor Daniels released a list of the books he was reading to prepare himself for the job. He's curious, what's on your reading list now that you're in the job?
Well, I still read a lot about higher ed, most recently a book by former President Bowen, a former president of Princeton, who's written a number of these. His latest one is about governance in the current era. I've just finished a book called The End of Doom, which is a very good encapsulation of the positive trends in science and environmental protection and so forth, how technology of the kind we do a lot of at Purdue is producing and will produce a more environmentally friendly future. I'm reading a book right now called Tocqueville in Arabia, I guess it's called. It's I'm very early into it, but it's about a scholar's attempt to look at the Middle East as de Tocqueville looked at America in its early formative years. And I'm trying to remember what else. I read a lot of World War I and continue to books because I've been teaching a course on that subject, and so there's usually one of those in the stack somewhere.
Another question came in. Matthew Ferris wrote in. He says he's a graduate student in biomedical engineering, and he wants to know about making graduate school more accessible. He says, how accessible and achievable is a combined 4+1 Bachelor of Science and Master of Science? In other words, basically a fifth-year master's degree program. He wants to know your thoughts on the role of those sorts of programs at Purdue and whether there can be any changes made to make such a thing more widely available.
I think it's a great question, and I'll take it up with his dean, but with others as well. We have some programs like that, and they prove that it's a viable concept in certain disciplines. Why not explore it in others? A much-discussed topic in higher ed has been the growing length of time it takes to achieve graduate degrees, specifically PhDs. And a lot of people are concerned about that. So anything that might accelerate the time in which people can achieve these degrees and credentials is worth a look.
It's interesting to me that there was this college scorecard and other things that have come out in the last couple of weeks. And it seems, as someone who's sort of watched higher education coverage the last few years, that we've gone from talking about graduation being a four-year thing to being almost exclusively a how many people graduate in 6 years or less thing. And I'm not quite sure what to make of that, except to remember my own college experience where it was, you go to college for 4 years. That's the way it was. Has this changed? Am I looking at a change in higher education that people are now looking at it as more of a 5 and 6 year thing, just as the way it goes?
Oh, it's changed, Stan. And you're a young guy, but you can apparently have been surprised, as many of us were when we first encountered this. Yeah, higher and higher percentages of students are taking more than 4 years. And that's why we have made a point of emphasis. I was so pleased that our students, in fact, conceived of this set of objectives, 4-3-2-1, and the first one is graduate in four. Now, we have some programs that are excellent programs that just require longer than four, co-op programs and others, fields of study where we encourage internships and work experiences. No problem there. Pharmacy is another example.
You could see something like a biomedical engineering.
Sure. You know. So, in fact, the people should understand when you see these six-year data and four-year data, they do have a flaw, and everybody acknowledges it. They are only counting students who showed up in the old-fashioned way in the fall and finished at the same school, let's say, in 4 years. That misses, I've seen estimates in Purdue's case, at least 10% who transferred either into Purdue and graduated. We don't get to count those. Or transferred from Purdue somewhere else and graduated. We don't get to count those, and neither does the receiving institution, by the way.
So those students go into some sort of like academic limbo?
Well, no, they work. It works out fine. But, you know, with something in some schools, a third of students transfer around. That's another phenomenon in the last 2-3 decades. And so all the critics are saying is that there is a perfectly obvious undercount here. But to keep apples and apples, that's the way they've been counting it up to now. But look, in our most recent census, for the first time in Purdue history, 4-year graduation jumped above 50%. And as I say, that doesn't count these other categories. We don't exclude from that the pharmacy students who can't graduate in 4 years. We know we got to do better, but the rate of improvement's been rapid. And it's very promising.
Do you think that colleges should be ranked and/or judged differently based on the types of programs and the expectations of how long it should take? Because I went to a small liberal arts school for my undergrad. It was expected. You were in and out in 4 years. There was no graduate program you could be doing. So if you were not out in the spring of your senior year, that was odd. Purdue, you're saying, has programs that take a little more time than that. Ostensibly, the students here are studying slightly different things than the students at my alma mater were studying. So should you have separate scorecards based on what the university's rubric says?
Oh, I think it would be helpful, again, just for accuracy's sake, to normalize, so to speak, the numbers. I don't want to overstate this. I've looked. It wouldn't change Purdue's graduation rates enormously if you recognized the special circumstance of co-op students, for example, or pharmacy students, maybe. But in the interest of accuracy, it would give people a clearer idea of how long it takes at School A versus School B.
This is Indiana Public Broadcasting's monthly conversation with Purdue President Mitch Daniels. You can always send questions for this show to news@wbaa.org. You can tweet them at WBAA News on Twitter as well. You and I talked last month on this program about the future of tenure at Purdue, and the university's in the process of making some changes. And you said You didn't think that the changes would make it more difficult to get tenure. You didn't think that it would be anything like tenure going away, as there have been worries at the University of Wisconsin campuses. So I want to ask you, were you surprised at all when the university's faculty senate came back and essentially line item vetoed in red ink this giant portion of changes that want to be made, especially the portion relating to having to justify the mentorship you're doing, which comes out of our discussions about the Purdue Gallup Index?
Oh, I don't know. The first of all, there's no veto. It's not their decision. The statutes, bylaws, and policy of the school are crystal clear. This is the trustees' decision. And the role of the faculty through the Senate is advisory. And so they have advised, and I know their advice will be taken very seriously. The board was ready to act in July at the request of the provost, postponed any action so the faculty could have another round, offer another round of advice. And they have, and you know, it's up to the trustees what to do about it. Somebody tallied it up. Of the documents produced by the faculty, Senate, the trustees ratified 99%+ of all the words on a word count basis, did ask for more emphasis in two or three places, and the Senate at least disagreed with most of that. So we'll see what happens. But it's the give and take process of the way it's supposed to operate. But an outcome in which 99%+ of the wording is just exactly as the faculty wrote it, and the trustees make a couple edits. Sounds at least balanced, wouldn't you say?
Well, while we're talking about the numbers of it all, you're a numbers guy, and you come on this program on a monthly basis with some interesting statistics that we ask you about. And so I was thinking about this as a quantitative measure, and mentorship is one of those things that's, it seems at least on the surface, somewhat harder to say, other than I've spent X hours with these students mentoring them. It's one of those things that's harder to justify than here are the number of papers I have published, for instance, as an academic. Is it possible that the numbers are part of the problem here, that this is a more mathematical thing?
No. I mean, tenure is a highly subjective decision in the end. You know, you can count the papers, but where were the papers? And how highly regarded are the journals in which they appeared? The tenure documents, you know, they're very comprehensive, are stacked with letters from colleagues here or elsewhere testifying subjectively to somebody, usually to somebody's fitness and so forth. So it's nothing particularly different about this. I think some good questions were asked. I'm sure the trustees will debate it about, you know, what counts and what doesn't, what in terms of showing interest in personal interest in students. The faculty, future faculty, because that's what we're talking about here, people entering or early in the tenure process, deserve to know what sorts of things will satisfy this requirement. But, you know, the other current must-do items, and there are several in the tenure policy, must show research excellence. That's not purely objective, must show teaching, high-quality teaching. That is certainly not easily or quantified. So this one I don't think would be much different, but they deserve clarification on that and other points. The faculty are very interested in at-risk students. Somebody raised a good question. Okay, who exactly are we talking about? So we'll see what the in the end, it's the trustees' decision. But I think listening to them, no one should misunderstand. All they're really saying is if in the future someone wants to secure what amounts to lifetime employment at Purdue University, they have to have shown some interest in students. At least they're just looking, they're just guarding against somebody who really would prefer not to dirty their hands with the business of advising, counseling, mentoring, otherwise coaching students at this in the way we know is so important to their growth. So I think that's all it is. So
do you see that, for instance, student letters of recommendation are going to gain in necessity?
I don't think we see very many of those, if any, now. But yes, that might be one very simple way. Just as faculty now secure letters of endorsement from faculty colleagues, maybe at some other school, who have admired their work. This would be one, might be one very simple way for someone to illustrate that they have taken at least some interest, shown some personal interest, invested a little of their own time and effort in the educational growth of young people. And that's, I think that's all I've heard the trustees saying they think ought to be part of this fundamental decision.
Is it fair to say that you would side with the trustees on the idea of we need to have more shows of mentorship if you want tenure at Purdue going forward?
You can mark me down as thinking this should be a student-centered institution, and that a faculty member who has anything to do with particularly undergraduate education — that's not all our faculty, by the way, it's another clarification that probably should be made — but that, yes, it is entirely reasonable to me to say that you ought not get lifetime employment here if you're someone who just cannot be bothered to have office hours, cannot be bothered to spend time with a student who's struggling, or who asks for the kind of academic counseling that might make them more successful.
I think about this discussion and the discussion about whether students should be tested for student growth, and it seems like a couple of recent examples where the faculty, maybe just the faculty senate — I won't generalize the faculty as a whole — but the faculty senate has been somewhat at odds with the trustees, and there have been back and forth discussions on both of these topics and many others. But I wonder if you think that there has been an increasing tide in some respects of those two groups of people kind of looking at each other from afar going, I'm not really sure what you're trying to do here.
I don't have the basis of comparison. If so, I think it's fairly modest. The vast majority of things come before the trustees, they simply rubber stamp. Happily so, I think. I'm talking about nominations and policies that involve the faculty. If governance is truly to be shared, then the trustees deserve to share in something, especially since the rules of the place give them the final authority over almost all such decisions. So I think it would be unsupportable to suggest that in any way they've overstepped any bounds. You know, across the country, there is a fairly substantial, growing movement that says to governing boards in general, hey, you are not living up to your responsibilities. Just like the corporate boards not that long ago were seen as being too complacent, too compliant maybe, with management. Likewise, a lot of people are saying if these boards have authority that they are not and have responsibility that they are not meeting, and authority they are not using. So I don't think anyone could allege that the Purdue board has been too aggressive.
Do you find yourself, and I've noticed the provost on this last issue, I feel for the guy because it seems like he's got one arm in one side and the other arm in the other side, and they're both pulling opposite directions. Do you feel that way at all, that you and he are kind of in the middle between these two groups of people and having to sort of mediate some of these discussions?
Well, I think mediation is part of our job, absolutely. All sorts of decisions get made that we won't talk about on this program because they just get worked out. And always that's the right answer. And I think everyone has tremendous respect for the faculty, the heart of the place. There are some decisions which are just purely administrative, which someone else should be responsible for. There are some decisions, lots of decisions, that get made entirely by the faculty about academic policy and so forth. And then there's some in the middle that get shared. And provost is a good advocate for the faculty. And again, in this most recent case, likewise in the other one we talked about student growth, his interventions have been, let's take more time, let's get more input, let's let the faculty work on this more. And I think that's he's doing his job appropriately when he does.
I'm interested how you think the faculty see you. Do you think they see you as more of, because they're going to see you, I think, as someone who might take a side, either with the trustees or with them, because obviously one group hired you and you have, you know, been in the faculty in some portion yourself, and so you've got hands in both of these. How do you think you're seen? Do you think that people put you in one camp or the other, whether that's true or not?
I can't answer it, Stan. You'd have to ask. I mean, we've got 1,800 just tenure track faculty and several hundred more in other categories. And one thing you love about them is they all have their own strong views about everything. So I think you get every opinion you can imagine in there. But I'll just say that across the whole faculty, I'm having a great time. I think I've made a lot of friends. I get a lot of positive comment. I think they know I admire them. I want to be their advocate. I'm out boosting them. Every time I get a chance to boost Purdue University, I'm talking about our faculty either individually or collectively. So, you know, will we agree on everything? No. And will my responsibilities to the institution occasionally require me to do things that that are less than unanimously applauded by the faculty, but try to do them in a constructive and positive way and try to minimize any disagreements we have.
We've got just a few more minutes with Purdue University President Mitch Daniels on our monthly conversation with him here on your local public broadcasting station. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. You can always send questions to news@wbaa.org or tweet them at WBAA News on Twitter. On to a couple of other things. There's been talk recently about the university doing what's called cluster hiring, and this is an interesting idea to me as someone who appreciates sociology. The idea is if you hire a whole bunch of people simultaneously, then what one of the things that does for you is helps you increase diversity because you're picking up on a lot of people who share a common trait, but beyond that one common trait, that's a diverse group of people. Purdue has talked a lot about trying to increase its diversity, trying to have a more diverse faculty. Do you think something like a cluster hire is the way the university will eventually decide to go? We should say there's no plans for it right now, but it's something that's being talked about as, hey, maybe we'll do this.
Actually, we do this, have done this.
Specifically for the purposes of diversity.
Well, one hopes that it'll make a contribution. Maybe a large one. We'll have to see. I think that the so-called cluster hiring that has happened that I've seen in the last 2-3 years, pretty encouraging. I think it's often aimed at fostering a interdisciplinary or more, let's say, intellectually diverse approach to a given area or problem or research opportunity. But if it turns out to also help us find and recruit those scarce and much sought after faculty that we're so interested in, that'd be great.
And a lot of times it starts out with what happened, for instance, at the engineering school a couple of years ago, where they say, all right, we need to hire a whole bunch of faculty in a short period of time. Let's go find a bunch of talented engineers. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that that's a different thing, especially with respect to the laws on hiring, than it is trying to say, yes, we want to increase our faculty size, but we also want to increase what they look like, where they come from, things like that. Is it a bit of a slippery slope to do this? Because you could run into a situation hypothetically where you have two candidates who on paper and through the interviews look materially the same, one white, one black, let's say, and hiring laws would say you can't make this choice based on the fact you think you need more black faculty. But if you're doing it that way and one of your stated goals is be more diverse, there's going to be a temptation there, it would seem like.
Well, it came up at the faculty meeting, and I've had emails since. Quite the example you mentioned, but you do have to recognize that now and then people will think that an inferior candidate's getting hired for a reason that is not related to their academic fitness. Now, that's an eye of the beholder problem. I hope it's not the case. I hope it's just a misperception. But, you know, there were at least two statements about that at the most recent Senate meeting. We all sat there and heard them. And I've had some emails from others who've said, yes, they believe they've seen this. Well, you know, you just I've been in through this in business with exact same interest. How do we diversify the business? That was a little different because you're not a public institution where the restrictions you're talking about in law are even more clear. Likewise, in government, you can make progress, however. You can make progress. And I always felt you could break a tie in favor of, and I said so openly, in favor of underrepresented categories. What you have to guard against is something that goes further than that, and I'm sure our team will.
So what do you think the likelihood is that Purdue institutes some sort of diversity cluster hiring program? The provost, when we talked to his office and a couple other people for a story we did a couple weeks ago, said it's not something we're definitely planning to do right now, but we also noticed that Provost Dutta was part of a large academic paper that came out about this very thing, about cluster hiring. And so clearly it's a topic he has researched and been interested in. Do you think it's something that'll become a strategy for diversifying Purdue going forward?
I'm going to defer to the provost on the means. He knows how committed we are to this end. The board is, I am, he is. This end being a more diverse faculty. How we get there and how we do it without creating injustice of the kind you just asked about is for him to figure out. This is very, very tough. And no one should underestimate the difficulty. The people that we hope we'll be able to recruit are going to be avidly sought after by people everywhere. They're just everyone has the same goal, and there are only so many great scholars to go around. So this is not going to be easy, and I sure wouldn't tie his hands from using any legitimate tool. Maybe this will be one.
One last thing, just in our last 60 seconds, and I hope you find this fun to talk about, and I think it's fun to think about just because it was something you were connected to a few years ago. I have to have your opinion on what you think of Donald Trump as the current GOP poll front runner anyway.
I don't know what to make of it, except that it is clearly part of a broader phenomenon. You've got someone on the Democratic side who's radically extreme in their views. Unelectable, I think, nationally, but, you know, showing an awful lot of appeal to folks who are very, very disillusioned about something. You see it in other countries. You see extreme or even, let's say, crackpot politicians in other places.
Something that happened in Greece.
Greece, the UK, in labor recently. So this is not American. It's not a Trump-only phenomenon. It's not American-only phenomenon. And I think it reflects this extent to which people are everywhere, or many places, are understandably concerned about the efficacy of our institutions to deal with issues, specifically economic issues, that not long ago we assumed would continue to work out well.
All right. Well, that's the time we've got. Thanks, as always, for your time, and we'll do it again next month.
Thank you.
This has been Indiana Public Broadcasting's monthly conversation with Purdue President Mitch Daniels. Remember, you can find these programs archived at wbaa.org. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Enjoy the rest of your day.